that I just test you when I've contested you. And I'm sorry, I've got you in a tizzy. You're clearly much too busy for this shit. I see you running around with self-appointed crown. Make fucking way or bow down. And I sometimes forget, the more I know, the less I know, you know. And I realize I'll never take your spot, no, I hadn't. But God, how could I? My minimum wage is a gentle reminder of how negatively giving up for my future. At least I'm not the only one. 25 roommates and shit, she sounds really fine.
Good evening, listeners. I do hope we're past the language watershed. I really wanted to play that song because that is a song by a band called Rusted Tongue. Now, welcome to Stinky Talks to Steph. My name's Stinky and I'll be talking to Stephanie Sobrinskas, who I met in the folk punk scene, and that was her band Rusted Tongue with their track Infallible You. Welcome to the program, Stephanie Sobrinskas. Thank you for joining us tonight here on 3CR's special International Women's Day broadcast.
Thank you so much for having me on, Stinky. I really, really appreciate it.
I've wanted to talk to you for a while because I think the 3CR listeners would be very interested in the work you're doing. You're a writer, producer, podcaster, and you're very active in advocacy for a cleaner energy future. Tell us, how did you get interested in the renewable energy field?
Sure. So I can't lie and say this has been something that has fascinated me since birth. It's nothing like that. I guess I have come to advocating for renewable energy from a concern of climate and climate change, and also the social, including the social justice elements of climate. So I grew up on Gunai Kurnai land in the Latrobe Valley, and the Latrobe Valley, for folks who don't know, was Victoria's power generating hub, or still is at the moment. So it's produced up to 85% of Victoria's electricity, which has been supplied largely by fossil fuels. And we also have gas and things like that in Gippsland too. But I grew up kind of in the Simpsons-esque life, surrounded by these steam stacks or cooling towers. And it just kind of seemed normal to me to have giant holes in the ground and all of this industrial landscape. And my tatukas, which is Lithuanian for grandpa, he worked in the power station. So he came over here in the late 40s and went and worked on a shovel, digging coal out of the mines there. So I guess there's this family lineage that I've always known that my tatukas' work is kind of what helped set my family up, and he was an SEC man till the 90s. So that's kind of the background there, but I never thought that I would be interested in renewables from that. And I guess the way that came about is I ran away from Latrobe Valley as quick as I could, as soon as I could, pretty much, after high school, because it wasn't like a hip-hop happening place for somebody who's interested in music and art and different things. So there wasn't much to do there. So I moved to Melbourne for nearly a decade, and then life circumstances threw me back there in the Valley. And when I came back, it was really, really different, and I couldn't quite put my finger on what had changed. So I started discussing this with my very good friend, Josie Hess, who also moved back around the same time, and they had noticed that it was very different as well. So we decided to find out what was going on and make a film about it. And kind of what we found was it was the transition to renewable energy that had changed. So people were talking about mine rehab, that like one of the power stations had closed down. And when we were both at high school, everyone still thought they were going to go off and get a really, really excellent job at the power station that would make bank for life, sort of thing. So those were the good jobs in our community. And that just wasn't so anymore. So we started to explore what was happening with the renewable energy transition, what had happened with the Hazelwood mine fire, and then kind of put our climate anxiety and climate grief into working on film, media, and podcast projects and activism locally.
It's an amazing way to get there, because it means you've got so much more attachment to it, and it must be, yeah, a visceral connection. You mentioned the mine rehabilitation and the Hazelwood mine fire.
Correct, yeah.
That's interesting. You've done a lot of work around that in particular. There's a documentary that you guys made?
Yes, we've actually made two documentary shorts. One is called After the Smoke, and that is a retelling of the Hazelwood mine fire, which happened in 2014, from Wendy Farmer, who was an incredible community health and climate advocate in Latrobe Valley, and how this moment in time, the Hazelwood mine fire, drove her to action and to speak up for the community. And we've also worked on Ashes to Aftermath, 10 years on from the Hazelwood mine fire, which is a micro doc series, which you can watch in a 27-minute chunk, but it's kind of the perspectives of five or six different people, and their reflections 10 years on. And we also made a really big impact campaign around the After the Smoke film short, in which we brought the community back together 10 years on from the Hazelwood mine fire to have a look at what had changed and to give space to talk about this tragedy that it was. And yeah, I think a lot of people, I had this realization last year when we were Josie and I were doing an interview with somebody, and they asked us where we were when the Hazelwood mine fire happened. And we were at White Knight in the city. So the Hazelwood mine fire is happening. The whole of Latrobe Valley, which powers our energy, is having this epic fire. They're shrouded in smoke, but the power stations are still running enough to put on White Knight, which was a light art display thing. So that was honestly where I was at the time. And it didn't register to me what was going on in the valley until speaking to my family. But looking at it now, that's wild that people didn't know, and it has had such ongoing health effects, and it was absolutely devastating at the time as well for the community.
As a member of the community, you're aware of it, but I only sort of found out about it from you many years after the fact. So I suppose for any listeners who aren't familiar, tell us about what happened.
Sure. So the Hazelwood mine was known as Australia's dirtiest power station. Let's start there.
Okay.
So Hazelwood wasn't just a really big part of the community. It had lots of jobs, and attached to that is a huge mine. Now, when I say this mine is huge, it's 18 kilometres in circumference, and like it's been dug up for coal for nearly 100 years. So 18 kilometre circumference is the size of the Melbourne CBD.
Yeah.
So we have this giant hole, and it's four lanes of highway across from the town, like where all of the houses are. That's it. Or a fence and, you know, a little bump in the road so you can't quite see the mine, but you can't avoid this hole. It's there,
yeah.
On just right nearby. And so basically there had been surrounding bushfires happening. It was a very, very high bushfire season, and some embers got into the mine, and coal is extremely combustible. So the mine caught on fire and they just could not get it under control. It was like letting off toxic smoke for 45 days. They
Wow.
had emergency responders in the mines like constantly, and they did not move the community out of the town, the surrounding areas, which were thick in smoke. There was some, response happening on the ground where different people had started documenting some of the health effects that were occurring. So, for example, people started reporting headaches and started feeling sick. People's pets were dying. There was just ash everywhere. So we had work of different community groups on the ground that were getting that information and trying to pass it on to the correct sources, and were just getting pushed back again and again. Their info wasn't being taken seriously. And then it was Voices of the Valley was one of the groups who started investigating, hey, if animals are dying, are people dying? So they started going through the newspaper reports in the Express, looking at the death notices, looking at like the RSL logs and things like that of people that had died, and they found evidence that there was an increased amount of deaths during the mine fire. There's an incredible book for anyone who's a reader called Hazelwood, and that's by Tom, I've forgotten.
That's Tom Doig, Doig. Tom Doig is the author of Hazelwood, the book.
And that is an account of on the ground. He came down and spoke to people who were affected by the fire. And there is some harrowing retellings of people who just couldn't keep the smoke out. You couldn't hang your clothes up outside. You couldn't wash them. People were still eating their vegetables and things like that from the garden, but it was all covered in horrid, horrid soot. So anyway, Voices of the Valley and other community groups pushed to have the mine operator, which was GDF Suez, taken to court for their responsibility in not keeping the community safe, to find out if there was any wrongdoing and if there were deaths. And so there was two mine fire inquiries, and they were found to have known risks that meant that they weren't protecting the community properly, that they didn't have proper firefighting equipment. For example, the hoses and things that they had inside the mine, right down the bottom, were all on wooden posts. So you couldn't actually get the water because the posts just burnt. And when the SEC sold off Hazelwood in the 90s, when it became privatized, they started selling all of the copper piping that was the firefighting equipment off for money, for
Oh
scrap,
my
because it was all made of
goodness.
copper. So it was just gross negligence on the part of this mining operator was found, basically. We had all of these other implementations in place, and those are some of the changes that Josie and I were seeing in the community. So there was big money put into the community, and it's kind of what put climate and what put mine rehabilitation and the end of industry on the table in a bigger way than it ever had been in the Latrobe Valley as well.
It's a shame that something has to devastate an entire community before people prick up their ears.
Absolutely. And I think we really do kind of see that time and time again, that it takes a big bushfire or it takes a disaster for people to really realize the cost of the way that we are living on the planet, the things that we're taking, and that brings it into reality, which is a real shame because we can see these things occurring around the world and here, but it does oftentimes take a big tragedy to drive action.
Some of the projects you've been a part of, you've got the documentary on ABC, you've got the other documentary.
Microdocs, we call them. So they were released as individual social media content, and also they're available on YouTube to watch as well.
You also do a podcast as well, and that's something I'm interested in because you mentioned your colleague Josie. Now they are part of the podcast with you. So what's the podcast about, and where can people find it?
Sure. So the podcast is called Coalface. And Josie and I kind of started using this podcast as a way to explore all of these different elements of change and different things that were happening in the community. So the idea is that we interview an expert on whatever their field is. Largely, the first season has been around kind of mine rehab. We've got an episode of the Hazelwood on the Hazelwood mine fire and about water usage and things like that, because They want to turn the mines into pit lakes to stabilize them. So we interview an expert, and then we retell bits of the interviews to each other, and we get to the questions, and we have funny, hopefully funny banter about growing up in the valleys and all sorts of things. So you can find that on pretty much all the platforms. I think we're on Spotify, we're on Podbean, we're on all the regular suspects.
Another thing that you had a hand in actually putting together was this community day that you just touched on before. Tell us about that, because that sounds like an incredible opportunity for people to get their stories heard.
For sure. So for me, I think what drew me to documentary and in the first place was the fact that you can advocate for change through it. You can give people a platform to tell their own stories. So as soon as I've always been a storyteller, I've always liked writing, I've always liked these things, and I've always been an activist in one way or another. So being able to put those things together was really, really incredible for me. And then I found out about this thing called impact producing. And that is basically when you design a campaign around your documentary that has a goal of changing some kind of structure, changing the way people think, that aims to bring good and to, yeah, create an action from the story. So Josie and I both participated in the Doc Society's Art and Impact Fellowship and kind of learned a bit more about what that actually looks like and how you do that meaningfully. So it's not just about deciding, oh, this is what I think this X group of people I've made a documentary about needs, and so I'm going to get that for them and give that to them. It's like working with people on the ground to finding out what would actually help. So Josie and I thought that Wendy's story is very inspirational. So everyone should check out After the Smoke. It's an incredible story and she's a wonderful person. But we really loved about her that she had had this shift in herself because of this disaster. She had stepped up and become a leader, and she self-described herself as just a housewife prior to this time. And this really solidified her action, and she hasn't shut up since this happened. She's still advocating. She's an absolute badass. But we thought that Wendy's story could get people to take a step towards activism, and that would be something. So our kind of goal was to tour around Australia, do screenings with Wendy, and do capacity building workshops with people in different communities that are going through energy transition or industry transition, and try and get people to sign up to a local group. So that was our kind of idea. And it is still part of the impact came we it part of the impact campaign we rolled out. But in talking to people on the ground, we realized, hey, the 10-year anniversary of Hazelwood is coming up, of the mine fires coming up, and nothing is planned. So we found that in chatting with people, it was going to be more impactful to do something just for our community, to give people a chance to have their voices heard and a moment to like look back at what has changed for the better in our community with the shift to renewable energy and things like that, and where we still had work to do. And also we wanted it to be an opportunity for people to learn and interact with this idea, because we found a lot of people, unless you were interested in, say, the health outcomes from the mine fire, it's not something you're actively hearing about. So we wanted to be able to give people the chance to ask questions. So we organized a series of panels, amongst other things. Like we had, I think, about 42 groups involved in the day. We had nearly 1,000 people come throughout the day, and we put on all free food for everybody and all free kids entertainment. That was really important to us as well. Like we wanted to not have any barriers to access. So any barrier we could take away, we did. And we had the panels where you could ask the mine operators. We got all of the mine operators in the valley to come together, which was hadn't happened at the time, to talk about mine rehab and get people to ask some questions about that. And we had the Hazelwood Health Study as well, which have been doing long-term research on the health effects for community members from the mine fires. We had that there. So many people weren't aware of their work, and they weren't aware of the great health initiatives that we've had from their work, and also just from the mine fire inquiry and things like that. So we wanted to make sure that it was inclusive for everybody. So we had Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander groups there, and we got an artist to do a community mural. We had this incredible project called Bug Blitz, which teaches kids about bugs and the environment, and just all this really fun stuff to try and help this hard topic, because it is a hard topic. People lost their lives during this period, and they're still losing their lives. There are still people that are sick, and I really want to stress that point because it is an ongoing impact for our community. And they're finding, for example, with the Hazelwood Health Study, that people that were pregnant at the time of the mine fire, their children are more likely to have asthma and things like that. So there's been this really, really big effect, and it's only kind of a micro example of the effects of living by fossil fuels, generally speaking. So these ill health effects we see in people that work in the mines, we have like higher cancer rates, higher cardiovascular diseases, and things like that. And that is stuff that people don't think about often. And so, yeah, we wanted to give people the chance to think about it, to learn about it, and to find out what services could help them in the community if they needed them. And also, if they felt like it, to take a step towards community action. So that became the kind of backside of our impact campaign instead of the front, I guess. And learning about impact, well, this was my point, learning about impact and documentary is kind of what solidified this as a vehicle for me, because I think we change hearts and minds through storytelling and through sharing and things like that. So I think if we take a moment to listen to people and learn about their perspectives, we are better able to make good choices and help advocate for good choices, and that's really awesome to me. So
yeah, to attempt to bring together an entire community over something that you would think would be an issue community members had close to their hearts. Like, you did get pushback, which I found astonishing, because the goal was very obviously about inclusiveness and something that's going to benefit the Gippsland community or mine communities. How's it been for you and Josie dealing with, well, some of the usual suspects, those voices that aren't going to be listening to the issues, are going to staunchly defend coal, or, how has that been for you too?
So I guess for me, it has been no worse than anywhere else that you try and use your voice for something, as like I'll speak as a cis female person. So I feel honestly like the work I've been doing is largely, aside from the filmmaking and the podcasts and that, mostly I just talk to people. That's kind of the activism I do. I talk to people, I ask questions, I do surveys, I do like that kind of stuff, and try and learn about people's perspective. And so I feel that, I feel my life as a female person and as a bit of a weirdo and a queer person has kind of equipped me really well to deal with angry, middle-aged, mostly white men who come and have a go at me. I feel also, kudos to my dad. My dad loves to argue, and my parents are quite conservative compared to me. And so, yeah, I've been arguing with my dad since I could talk pretty much. And so I feel that I've been equipped to deal with that. But there has been pushback. And we, like Josie and I in particular, sometimes it feels that people don't take our work very seriously. And I don't know if that is like a gendered thing from, where it comes in. But I think that we are often called girls. People will be like, "Oh, the coal face pod girls," and like we're one, both in our 30s, and two, not both women. And so that's kind of been frustrating, and that has been a recurrent kind of theme. But I guess to an extent, that's kind of worked in our favor as well to get interviews and things like that, because people don't take it seriously at all.
Okay, so they think they're going to include you because you'll be an easy mark.
Yeah, precisely. So, yeah, so that's just me projecting. I'm not sure, but it has felt like a little, yeah, there's been times when we've both been infantilized and things like that. I don't know. I just always remember whenever I'm doing a market or something like that, there's always some man who wants to come wave his finger in my face and be like, "Oh, my friend who put a wind turbine in his backyard, in his paddock in New South Wales, and then had to pay to decommission it." And I was like, "Oh, really? Where is this? Like, that's a problem. Like, Can I have some more information? Like, I'd love to be able to help advocate. And they can never give me the information because it's never something that's happened to someone they know. It's something they've, I don't know, read in the Murdoch press or something like that, or that happened in another country and that they've now convinced themselves is reality. And so, yeah, I've become quite accustomed to that. And I'm not saying I know everything, but people don't, like, I don't know everything about renewable energy. I'm not an expert. I'm not in the science field. I'm not an engineer, but I do know quite a bit. I have been doing quite a lot of learning, and I think there's just a lot of misunderstanding from other people about it as well. And there is very much an allegiance to coal because people's families, like mine, like people's grandparents were in coal. They were in coal. Their kids are in coal. And so it feels like when we're saying that we're moving on from it, that they've been doing something wrong, which they haven't, like we just now know better. And also there's a fear because this has been people's livelihoods. So, and that's the thing too, like we need to have proper opportunities to replace the jobs that have been traditionally in the mining industry, which in our community have been, is quite a lot. So I think in Australia, it's like 2% of the jobs are in mining in power, or just over two, which isn't a large amount in the scope of things, but in communities that it has been such a central part of that industry, that is huge. I think I like to come with as much compassion as I can with that as well, and advocate for people who, like, you know, to be for new industries, to be getting new industry, to be getting fairly compensated, to be getting fairly retrained and meaningfully retrained, not just like, oh well, you know, Bob who's been I don't know, cleaning cooling towers for his whole life can now go get a job in IT and security, because that is not meaningful. Like, what, he might not want that. So, yeah, that's something I try and I really want to get across, because I do care about people's livelihood and jobs, and it is important to me that there is social justice with the transition to renewables.
It sounds like exhausting but rewarding work when you actually do get into a conversation with someone that's willing to hear what you're having to say. And I suppose starting that conversation with believing their tales, their boomer fan fiction, is a great way to engage with them, saying, oh, really, how can I help? And that's something that I think certain types of personality aren't able to take that tone. I think that's working in your favour, not just having argued in the past, but the fact that you're compassionate and you're genuinely concerned, I think that's going to help at least have the conversation with people.
I do like to hope so.
yeah, because otherwise it's just this opposition stuff that's really tiresome and gets no one anywhere. Okay, well, we're almost out of time. I would really like you, if possible, to let people know how they can get involved, if there's any organisations they can join, if there's any information places they can, you know, where they can find information on how to get involved.
Sure. If you're living in somewhere in Victoria and you care about the environment, there are a number of great groups that you can look to. I'm a local organiser with Environment Victoria, who have a Victoria-wide action. So that would be a great place. They have also been very active in the mine rehabilitation and fossil fuel space, and against gas, or campaigning to get gas moved out of Victoria. So that's a great place for information to go to as well. At the moment, I haven't really touched on this, but I'm working on the Nuclear Free Gippsland campaign. So you can go to our website, which is nuclearfree.com.au, to see the actions that are happening on there. And also just like a big shout out to groups like Friends of the Earth and the Australian Conservation Foundation and places like that, because they do incredible work. You can always volunteer for something, I absolutely promise. And a lot of the organizations that I've listed and others that I haven't, they do really great capacity building things as well. So you get to learn skills, you get to meet people that are like-minded, and you get to try and make positive change in your community. If you want to check out my work and Josie's work as well, you can check out lifeaftercoal.com.au. And also, yeah, Coalface Pod on all of your favourite platforms.
All right. Well, look, thank you so much for your time today, Steph. I really appreciate it. And I really appreciate the work that both you and Josie do. It's not easy. And I know that sometimes you have to go down rabbit holes you don't necessarily want to go down just for your own protection. So hopefully, knowing that more people are going to be hearing about this, hopefully that steels you for the next fight you have going.
Thank you so much, Dale. And just too, while I'm on the air, I just want to give a massive shout out to all of the women and gender non-conforming folks that are in activism, because there are so many and so many doing incredible work in the renewable energy space. And we would absolutely be lost without the people power of women and gender non-conforming people in this movement. So keep it up. I see you and you're fucking awesome.
Thank you, Stephanie Sibrinskis, legend. Unfortunately, that's all I've got time for, but thanks very much to 3CR for their wonderful International Women's Day broadcast. Stinky out.